The Gospel reading from Luke. But I say to you who are listening, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, do not withhold even your shirt. Give to everyone who asks of you, and if anyone takes away what is yours, do not ask for it back again. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you expect to receive payment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. Instead, love your enemies. Do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, for He Himself is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For the measure you give will be the measure you get back. This is the gospel of grace. Thanks be to God.
In the fall of 2020, I began my seminary journey at Bright Divinity School. The Master of Divinity program is 81 credit hours. And last semester, I registered for one of my final required courses, Understanding Early Judaism, with Jewish scholar Dr. Ariel Feldman. Dr. Feldman's thoughtfulness and thoroughness in his pedagogy opened my mind in ways I didn't even know it was closed. American historian Daniel J. Boorstin, who served as the Librarian of Congress from 1975 to 1987, said, "Education is learning what you didn't even know you didn't know." And last semester, we studied the origins of the Shema, the central affirmation of Judaism. The prayer was recited as part of regular services in the ancient temple in Jerusalem. And it serves as the climax of the liturgy on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish year. It is often said as one's dying words, including Jewish martyrs who throughout the ages made it their final profession of faith before being put to death. From Deuteronomy chapter 6, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. Keep these words that I am commanding you today in your heart. Recite them to your children, and talk about them when you are at home and when you are away, when you lie down and when you rise. Bind them as a sign on your hand, fix them as an emblem on your forehead, and write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." The Shema describes a love that is unreserved, all demanding, at all times, in all places, and in all circumstances. Thoughts are to be focused, words are to be spoken, and deeds are to be done. But Jesus added a second commandment as an addendum, remember? And you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Well, actually, being Jewish, Jesus learned that at the synagogue and at home. Jesus learned God's commandments as he read and studied the Torah. Love for neighbor, of course, is found in the Hebrew Bible, in the 19th chapter of Leviticus. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against any of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Jewish traditions know, teach, and practice love for God and neighbor. But Jesus said in the Gospel according to Matthew, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." But Matthew 5:43 has been misinterpreted. Hating your enemy is not a biblical command. When Jesus is preaching to the crowd, "You have heard that it was said," he isn't referencing the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. This command to hate your enemy is from non-biblical traditions. The all-inclusive love Jesus is preaching imitates God's indiscriminate love and mercy for all people. Jesus commands us to love our enemies. Love your enemies is uncompromising. People have been ready to love their neighbor and hate their enemy, but Jesus goes beyond that. Jesus calls us to widen our scope of love, telling us we shouldn't be selective in our love. But who are our enemies? What is Jesus really saying? We shouldn't just quote the Bible and assume we know what it means. Understanding Jesus' time and culture is deeply contextual. And how we interpret Jesus' Sermon on the Plain about loving our enemies says a lot about our Christian ethics, both individually and collectively. We exist as God's creatures in order to fully live into the world in which we've been gifted to coexist. Our actions, our ethics, our decisions, our conclusions are not only about our place in this world, but our connection to all other beings and our connection to God. And before we can obey Jesus' commandment of loving our enemies, we must discover to whom Jesus is referring. The etymology of the Greek word ekthros, which has been translated to enemy in the New Testament, is an adjective which means hostile, or so strikingly unfamiliar that one naturally reacts with repulsion. Ekthros is a social word. It describes someone unfamiliar to or unfamiliar of you. In The Cost of Discipleship, Dietrich Bonhoeffer writes, "The enemy was no mere abstraction for the disciples. They knew him only too well. They came across him every day. And then there was the enemy, which would immediately occur to every Jewish person, the political enemy in Rome." Jesus' command is to love whomever you consider other. Bonhoeffer says, "The will of God, to which the law gives expression, is that we should defeat our enemies by loving them. And who needs our love more than those who are consumed with hatred and utterly devoid of love? Where is love more glorified than where she dwells in the midst of her enemies?" St. Augustine said, "We human beings are a question unto ourselves." Then how are we to understand these other people, these strangers who do not participate in our way of being human, the other who thinks and acts so differently? The moral measure of Christian theology will increasingly be taken by its capacity to welcome the stranger and to guard their dignity and well-being. And the belief that human beings are created in God's image, imago Dei, defines our relation to God and to the rest of creation. We are created for and called to a unique companionship with God, with one another, and with the world. And this companionship involves responsiveness to God's freeing us to love and loving us into freedom. In the book Radical Love by Patrick Chang, he speaks of a love so extreme that it dissolves our existing boundaries. Jesus' death can be understood as the end of endless divisions between insiders and outsiders. Yet it's not enough to refrain from hostile acts. Jesus gives directives. Love your enemies. Do good deeds. And lend, expecting nothing in return. Our responsibility to others is not simply to put on a happy face and have a good attitude, but to find ways to do them good, which is a much more practical goal than trying to stir up the emotion of love. We must take action in our well-doing. God is kind, loving, and merciful to the person who believes and who has committed their lives to the divine, and equally kind, loving, merciful, forgiving to the person who has grieved God's heart. And if we're being honest, that dichotomy isn't just present in our society. It's present inside each of us, too. God's mercy flows down upon us when we deserve it, but thanks be to God, even when we don't. And there are innumerable stories which demonstrate God's ever-flowing stream of mercy throughout the Old and New Testaments. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, when Jesus demonstrates that mercy is not bound by race, culture, or religion. In God's mercy toward Jonah and Nineveh, which reveals God's desire to forgive the most sinful and oppressive nations. In the parable of the prodigal son, when the father's love is not contingent on the son's behavior, but on his return home. And with the thief on the cross, when in Jesus' final moments, he shows that no one is beyond redemption. Jesus says, "If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other cheek also." But when considering the context of ancient Israel's cultural customs, the left hand was associated with unclean tasks, such as personal hygiene. A backhanded slap to the right cheek would have been done with the right hand, which was the dominant and clean hand. And in the biblical context, being backhanded was an egregious act of insult and humiliation more than injury, and it was used to show blatant domination over another. But one can't be backhanded if they turn the other cheek. By turning the other cheek, the victim forces the oppressor into a moral and social dilemma. They either break social norms or escalate the violence in a way that acknowledges the victim as an equal. Turning the other cheek demands equality from the oppressor. And understanding the context, we see how the scripture aligns with Jesus' broader message of nonviolent resistance. Not passively accepting injustice, but confronting it in a way that reveals its inherent cruelty and seeks transformation. Beloved, please hear me say, Jesus was not asking anyone to submit to physical, mental, verbal abuse, or abuse of any kind without trying to make it stop. November 9th, 1938, has come to be called Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, which was the night the hidden and unofficial violence against the Jewish people turned open and official. Dietrich Bonhoeffer opened his Bible that night and read Psalm 74. And in the margin, he wrote his own completion of the question, how long? He wrote, how long, O God, shall I be a bystander? Although he came to Union Theological Seminary in New York City to study, Bonhoeffer found it impossible to stay in America. His American friends feared for his life and begged him to stay, but he felt he must go back and be with his people and resist the policies and power of Hitler. He and his brother-in-law were arrested for helping German Jewish people escape into Switzerland. And today, living in an era marked by rhetoric designed to foster division, one that every day is more and more reminiscent of Bonhoeffer's time, preparing this sermon was especially difficult. I have wrestled with Jesus' words more than ever before. Dr. Steve Shoemaker, who was my pastor while I was in the youth group at Broadway, wrote in his book, God Stories, perhaps this is at the heart of the cross. It will not let us be bystanders. Loving one's enemies isn't merely a personal endeavor, but a countercultural statement. Embracing this command does not mean compromising convictions, but approaching disagreements with a spirit of love and humility. And by doing so, we bear witness to the transformative power of the gospel in our fractured world. At the National Prayer Service, when speaking directly to the president on the morning of his inauguration, Bishop Marianne Edgar Buddy emphasized the need for unity and compassion, condemning a culture of contempt and advocating for respect and dignity across all differences. Did you notice the tone with which she spoke? And the carefully crafted language she used. In the final portion of her sermon, she referred to God as our God. In the name of our God, I ask you to have mercy upon the people in our country who are scared now. She didn't take an us versus them approach. She was counterculturally prophetic as she preached the inclusivity of the gospel while in the most beautiful way being actively inclusive. Seek understanding. Pray for your opponents. Practice empathy and promote unity. But continue to fight the good fight. Keep on keeping on, as the Reverend Lester Maples, my late grandfather, taught me. Stand up and speak out. But in your approach, be countercultural and engage in nonviolent resistance. Jesus said, "I am sending you out like sheep into the midst of wolves. So be as wise as serpents and innocent as doves." Many of you may know that the Beatles are my favorite band, and Abbey Road, their last recorded album, is my favorite. The Beatles' song, The End, ultimately ended up being the final track on their last recorded album. The final lyrics are, "And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make." And I've pondered these lyrics for years and clung to them throughout my life. In his 2021 book, The Lyrics, Sir Paul McCartney explained how he was always fascinated by the couplet as a form in poetry. "I was particularly fascinated," he said, "by how Shakespeare used the couplet to close out a scene or end an entire play. It was Shakespeare's way of saying, 'That's it, folks.' And the end was our way of saying the same. Ours is one of those couplets that can keep you thinking for a really long time." And interestingly, when adding the final thoughts to my sermon, Paul McCartney appeared on my TV performing The End in the final moments of the special celebrating 50 years of Saturday Night Live. But this thought-provoking concept didn't originate with the Beatles, nor with Shakespeare, nor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, nor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., nor St. Augustine. Our gospel text this morning concludes with the words of Jesus: "A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put in your lap, for the measure you give will be the measure you get back." When we extend mercy to others, when we're merciful as our God is merciful, even to those we might call enemies, we participate in a cycle of divine love, giving and receiving, healing and being healed. In Dr. Shoemaker's God Stories, he writes, "All love has manners, but not all manners have love." You can tell the difference. It's the difference between going to church to do something nice for Jesus or loving him with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. It's the difference between mumbling some hymn or dancing before God with all your might. True religion is not set up to make the respectable more respectable and to hell with all the rest, but to turn us passionately alive to go into the world with God's love. This radical way of living, this radical love, is more about creating a counter-cultural community and world. And when we learn to accept the grace and mercy God offers us, and then we extend that same grace and mercy to others, we will transform not only our relationships, not only our families, our churches, our country, and our world, but indeed, radical love will transform our very own hearts, and perhaps even the hearts of our enemies. Amen.